It's a very important concept that's discussed a lot in traditional Buddhism. So I'd like to discuss this a little bit, introduce you to the idea. However, I was slightly concerned driving down here that maybe there's some other things which are more important to talk about. I don't know what's up, but I don't want to kind of just start talking about what I want to talk about without giving you a chance. If anybody feels like something important we need to talk about today instead, or something very important on your mind. Yes?
I'd like to read more about generosity, which you talked about last week. Is there a book that you refer me to on that?
I think if you read Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, they have a discussion there on generosity and related things. Okay, so that's fine. So then I'm happy to talk about views. And perhaps the subject of views is current enough in the sense that tomorrow we have an election. Oh, I didn't finish pulling out my gear. By asking that question, so that doesn't say sounds so mysterious, today's D-Day, right? And I was actually quite moved, and I was listening to the radio driving down here, and was very moved by the whole event. And so I just wanted, because it was in some ways a very moving thing, whether you know whatever way you're moved, I just wanted to give that the chance to be processed here if that was necessary. Some children, this is from a Buddhist sutra. Some children were playing beside a river. They made castles of sand, and each child defended his castle and said, "This one is mine." They kept their castles separate and would not allow any mistakes about which was whose. When the castles were all finished, one child kicked over someone else's castle and completely destroyed it. The owner of the castle flew into a rage and pulled the other child's hair, struck him with his fist, and bawled out, "He has spoiled my castle. Come along, all of you, and help me to punish him as he deserves." The others all came to his help. They beat the child with a stick and then stamped on him as he lay on the ground. Then they went on playing in their sand castles, each saying, "This is mine. No one else may have it. Keep away. Don't touch my castle." But evening came. It was getting dark, and they all thought they ought to be going home. No one now cared what became of his castle. One child stamped on his, another pushed his over with both hands. Then they turned away and went back, each to his home. So what are our sand castles that we build and hold on to, and then night comes, a different perspective comes, and, you know, no big deal. What is it that we cherish so much in one context, and when we see it in a different context, maybe we have a very different relationship to it. And I think that views, opinions, beliefs are very much our sandcastles that we build, or castles in the air, I think, is an expression. And what's interesting from the Buddhist point of view is the question of how we relate to our views and opinions. And the issue of opinions and views, beliefs, I think many of you know, has become a very hot item in the 20th century. It used to be many centuries ago that people lived in very closed societies where there's basically one worldview and everybody agreed to it, and there wasn't that much room for disagreement or seeing a different way. And now we're all living on top of each other so much more, and we know each other, all the different cultures, so much better. And we have many, many different perspectives living side by side. And the questions of how different views and opinions and beliefs live side by side has become if nothing else, an academic industry among philosophers. And if there are two conflicting views about views. So one of the issues in the modern world is, what's the right view to have about views? What's the right belief to have about beliefs? And one kind of view about views is kind of what can be called the absolutist view. And this maybe is related to people who are fundamentalists. And there are fundamentalists in every religion, including Buddhist fundamentalists, which you should know about. An absolutist view is that there is some absolute objective truth or true way, and hopefully or probably you have that right view, and you're going to hold on to it and defend it. And often people who hold this view are easily threatened and respond to being threatened by a lot of violence, often a lot of even killing. The other kind of way of seeing it is maybe what can be called a constructivist attitude towards views, that all views, all opinions and beliefs are created, are human creations. And if we understand them as human creations, then they seem to lose their absolutist stance, their absolute perspective, absolute status. And then how do we relate to views and opinions then, if they're human creations? And then we have a whole wing of modern philosophy and religion that called relativism, that everything's relative in a sense. And a lot of people have tried to point out that Buddhism is very close to relativism. And I would argue that that's not quite so. In any case, the idea being that all identities and opinions are human creations. Now, if you don't like this idea that human identities and beliefs are human creations, then, and you try not to believe it, then there's a tremendous danger that you're going to be suckers for people who do. And there's a lot of people who are in the profession of manipulating public opinion and beliefs. There's public relations people in all kinds of corporations. There's advertisement. There's politicians of every sort. There is the military. The military has become, ever since the invasion of Grenada, and some 11 years ago, the U.S. military has become masters of manipulating the media. They felt they didn't do well, good enough during the Vietnam War, and they're not going to make the same mistakes again. So whether you're an absolutist or not, I think it's very important to realize how much public opinion is molded and created by people who are doing that intentionally for profit, for some kind of benefit. And the very word public opinion sounds very strange to me, that you're going to kind of create public opinion or manipulate public opinion. Because the public is made up of individuals. But so many people don't see the world as being made up of individuals so much as being made up of masses that can be manipulated. So Buddhist tradition tends very much to fall into the constructivist view about views, that all views are created, human creations, and they're all relative in a sense. The Buddhist word for being relative is they're dependently co-arisen, codependently arisen. And the Buddhist worldview, again, it's an opinion now, is that it's a worldview which is which sees the world as being so interdependently and interdependent that nothing exists independent of anything else. So no view stands out in any kind of absolute way apart from all other views or the rest of creation and the world and other humans. But more than views, more than holding some kind of views or some opinions or some beliefs, what Buddhism has tended to focus on, much more the early Buddhist tradition than the later Buddhist tradition, but I think throughout the Buddhist tradition in some sense, to some degree or other, Buddhist tradition focuses on our relationship to our beliefs and our views rather than the views and beliefs themselves. The way in which we hold our world, the way in which we hold our opinions, our views, our ideas, our identities, the way we hold our relationships with everybody else, the way we hold it with a tight fist or an open fist, open hand. Also, the Buddhist tradition has tended to be much more interested in practice than it has been in doctrine. And this is a generalization that you'll find exceptions to. But overall, scholars have pointed out that Buddhism has not been so interested in orthodoxy. And orthodoxy is orthodox doctrine. So much as it's been interested in orthopraxy is the word. Orthodox praxis, orthodox practice. And Buddhists have disagreed dramatically on beliefs and ideas. But as long as they felt some harmony about the practices they did, there was no tension or problem. And the major schisms in the Buddhist tradition tend not to come from beliefs, but tend rather to come from differences of opinions, feelings about or attitude, or different practices, doing different practices. Buddhism has often had a very pragmatic attitude towards beliefs, that the beliefs you hold are useful, or can be useful, as tools, as instruments, to further your own awakening and your own opening of your heart. And so rather than taking views as being an absolute thing you have to believe in, it's rather a pragmatic tool that's going to help you get somewhere, in a sense. So that the beliefs can be discarded. What's important is the open heart. I'm very much, as I mentioned, I think a few weeks ago, inspired by the earliest Buddhist tradition, the earliest suttas, before even the development of Theravadin thought, the Buddhism of Southeast Asia. And in that early period of Buddhism, the early sutras, you find two different attitudes, or two different teachings, about liberation, what liberation is. And maybe these don't exclude each other, they're not exclusive of each other, but you see two different kind of streams. And they can also be seen as exclusive of each other. You can interpret this both ways. But one way is that liberation involves a freedom from all attachment. So the definition of liberation is very, very much psychological. Attachments holding on to things, your views, opinions, ideas about yourself, to desires, cravings, hates, that attachment and clinging is a source of suffering. And liberation is simply releasing, opening that hand of clinging and living an open-handed way. The other way that the Buddhist tradition has talked about liberation is that liberation involves the recognition and insight into particular truths about reality. And these are such things as the Four Noble Truths, impermanence, no self. There's a whole list of truths which Buddhism wants to posit or claim. And seeing these very clearly are considered to be the prerequisites for enlightenment or awakening. And this may be, I don't know what the right term is, but as opposed to a psychological definition of liberation, this is more a philosophical one. Now it seems that in the oldest layer, of Buddhist literature, as far back as we can tell, the closest we can get to the Buddha himself, that body of literature is extremely concerned about views, about what views, opinions, and beliefs are about. In a text called the Sutta Nipata, which is considered to be the oldest, they talk over and over again about the problems and dangers in holding views and hold up, kind of as an ideal, having no views at all. In the Buddhist tradition, when they talk about views, and the Pali word is ditti, without qualifying what they're talking about, it invariably means bad or wrong views. Views have really bad press in Buddhism. Though they talk about good views or right views also. And in this early body of literature, they're much less concerned with the content of views as they are with the psychological state of the person that holds the views. What psychological state do you have when you hold a certain view? And they talk about, I'll read some of it to you. This is a translation that I made. This is really for those who care about the oldest piece of literature we can find in the Buddhist tradition. Those who stick to their own views and argue that this alone is true either bring blame upon themselves or obtain praise. Obtaining praise is a trifling thing and not enough to bring one tranquility. Realizing this, one should not dispute, seeing the peaceful state wherein there is no dispute. Those who consider virtuous conduct to be the highest say that purity comes through self-restraint. Having undertaken religious observance, they dedicate themselves to it, saying, in this alone we should train ourselves, and so attain purity. Claiming to be skillful, they remain in the treadmill of existence. If they fall away from their virtuous conduct and religious observances, they tremble at having failed in their task. Such people long for and desire purity like a lost person longs for a caravan guide. But by abandoning all virtuous conduct and religious observances, as well as both blameless and blameworthy actions, desiring neither purity nor impurity, one dwells unattached, cultivating peace. I'll read that again. This is a very radical thing for any religious tradition to say. And I've read this before, and people have accused me of trying to do a Zen number on early Buddhism. But this is what it says. But by abandoning all virtuous conduct and religious observances, as well as both blameless and blameworthy actions, desiring neither purity nor impurity, one dwells unattached, cultivating peace. Relying on ascetic austerities, fasting, or on what has been seen or heard from others, they speak of purity, but they are not free from craving for one existence after another. Craving leads to more craving and to suffering from confused views. Some say that a certain teaching is the highest, while others claim it is inferior. All of them claim to be adepts. Which then is right? They claim that their own teachings are perfect and that those of others are inferior. Thus contending, they dispute, considering their opinions to be true. If a teacher were truly inferior just because others criticize it, then no teaching could be established as the best, since all people firmly champion their own teachings while claiming that others' teachings are contemptible. In honoring their own teachings, they also praise their own path. If everything they say is true, then purity must be unique to them. Those who are upright and who have investigated the various teachings rely neither on others or on views. Not seeing one doctrine as better than another, they have gone beyond disputes.
I'm a view holder.
We all view holders.
But I have a concern.
Now,
because the underside of that statement seems to me to be translated, don't take any chances.
Interesting idea. Let me see if I can come back to that as we go through the talk, where it might fit in. Having untangled the tangle, a sage does not side with any side of a dispute. Calm among those who are not calm, a sage says, others may take them up if they desire. The wise have nothing to do with doctrines based on what has been thought out or seen or heard from others. They've set down their burden and are free, neither attached nor craving for anything. As our mindfulness becomes stronger, as we cultivate our awareness of our own inner processes, one of the things we become aware of is the cost, psychological, physical cost, towards holding in an attached way certain views. But we start noticing, more than that, I think at some point, the strong tendency we have of identifying and selecting out and giving preference to the certain kind of thoughts that involve opinions and identities and beliefs. And as your mindfulness becomes stronger, you become aware of the feeling state that's associated with being attached to views or holding views in a very tight way. And it's possible to become aware of the tightening, contraction all over the body. There can be tightness and contraction in the head, in the brain, in the body, in the stomach. And there's all kinds of other things you become aware of. For example, a feeling of separateness. It's possible to feel very separate from others, very contracted and removed, and creating a very sharp boundary between self and others. And often, I think, a contracted state, to feel yourself being in a contracted state, is a very good indicator that you have gone from simply having an opinion, having a view, to being attached to it. And the other thing that you start becoming aware of as you do mindfulness practice is the interplay or the interaction between views and emotions. And it's important, I think, to see how many different aspects of our life interact and interplay with each other. And have you ever had the experience of forming a negative opinion of someone? Maybe it was unbased, you don't know that yet. And so then you have kind of emotional reaction to them, you're kind of angry at them. And then you create this angry situation, and then it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The very thing that you formed your opinion about, you find out too late that you couldn't. Anyway, our emotions get hooked onto our opinions, and sometimes to a lot of people's detriment. And certainly opinions and views can be strengthened and hardened by such things as self-righteousness, aversion, things like the need for recognition. There's so many things that get complicated, get involved in the act of holding a view. And how many of us, I have, put forward a view in class. Not because, it was a good view or I cared, but basically I wanted to be recognized in the class as being smart or being doing something. Something else was going on besides, having a reasonable discussion. Opinions can get mixed up with anger. Sometimes reaction to boredom. I've spoken up sometimes because I thought the situation was boring and I wanted to juice it up. Views get tied in, very much involved with a lack of self-worth. Lack of self-worth, the feeling is a lack of self-worth is itself a view. Then that's a view. Some views are particularly clever at hooking themselves onto other views and entangling themselves in many other areas. And emotions have a strong impact on the choices we make and how we live our lives. So sometimes I think emotions, our emotional reactions, create our views and opinions about things. We generalize sometimes. Some person who is... someone who has one green eye and one blue eye happens to hold us up in the alley in San Francisco. And from then on, all green and blue-eyed people are, crooks. Because we're so. And I think it's kind of the emotional impact of being mugged is so powerful that I think it's almost a biological thing than to generalize. I think so much of prejudice comes out of fear. And we really need to realize how the power, what a powerful emotion fear is in creating views and opinions. And opinions themselves not only reinforce emotions, but they can also create emotions themselves. And you end up with a destructive loop between the two, between emotions and opinions and views. So the Buddhist tradition has a discussion of right views, and you can read some of the texts and they'll enumerate the different lists of right views that should be, could be held. But even in listing what right views are, it recognizes that you can be also attached to right views. And one of the most dangerous places to be attached to views is when your views are right. It's like, you know, gasoline and a match.
That's a near enemy of enlightenment.
So there's a discussion, there's a feeling of no views is the right view sometimes in Buddhism. And how I understand that is that there's no place to hang your hat. There's no place to plant your flag. It doesn't mean you don't have hats and flags. There's no place to hang it. There's no self to kind of identify with it. There's nothing to defend or nothing to threaten around a view. There's no place to hang your hat. So we need to have views. I mean, everybody has to have a view, have opinions about things. I guess politics is made up of views and opinions, and we certainly want to participate in the political world in some way. And I found it very revealing when I learned that in the early Buddhist tradition, one of the laws, one of the rules for the monastic community was that when there was an election within a monastic compound, within a monastery, every monk or nun who was there had to vote. Voting wasn't a right, it was a requirement. So a tradition which is anti-views requires you to kind of come down at some point to act also. So it's very easy to somehow take some of the Buddhist teachings out of context and not realize that some of these teachings that sound nihilistic at times existed together with teachings that involved very much being engaged in the world. So for example, the teaching of view, the teaching of no self, can be understood as being nihilistic. It has at various times. But it was taught by the Buddha together at the same time as requiring teaching and requiring a tremendous amount of personal responsibility at the same time. And the two had to be understood together. So we have lots of views. We have, just in terms of our meditation practice, there's, you know, interesting views, like we have opinions about gain, about progress, about where we stand on the spiritual path. You know, I'm hopelessly, you know, distant from ever being enlightened or understanding any of this, to, you know, I'm on the brink. Or I was visiting the meditation center Friday, and it was a ceremony in the meditation hall, and at some point the director of the hall of the meditation center came into the ceremony and wanted to know what she could do about Jesus, who had just arrived in the kitchen. So some people have gone over the brink. And Jesus was in the kitchen sink taking a bath. So views about the spiritual path. One of the interesting ones for most of us is the views about what we're going to get from doing our practice. We all have views about that. I think we all necessarily need to have views about that. But all views about what we're going to get about it, at some point or other, are going to be frustrated, I'm sorry to say. There's a lot of things that can be gained from meditation practice and a lot of benefits from doing meditation practice. Life is a little bit out of our control. And if you expect it always to be follow the kind of way you've set yourself up for it to follow. I don't know if I said that right. If you expect it to be what you want it to be, always, then you might have some disappointment. So Buddhism is more concerned about exploring our need for views and meaning for our life, than it is with positing meanings and views in itself. And that's a big difference. And that, I think, is a shift which I haven't seen in a lot of other religious traditions. A lot of traditions are very concerned about the right view and finding the views and coming to your own conclusion. But to step back and have maybe a slightly more psychological approach, say, well, what is the need you have for views? What's the need you have? Where does the need come from to have meaning, find meaning to life? And it's not claiming that there's no meaning to life, but have you ever explored the need for that meaning? And there's a whole range of the ways in which people need to find meaning in life. And maybe some of those ways, some of that range, comes from anxiety, fear, and neurosis, and things like that. Maybe they're unnecessary. And if you investigate the need, maybe sometimes you'll find that you can let go of the need. So when you, in relationship to views and opinions and beliefs, which religious people are famous for holding, there's this wonderful expression called spiritual materialism. And as Trungpa, who coined the words, defines it, spiritual materialism is the ego's attempt to appropriate spiritual ideas and practices for one's own purposes. So to take religious ideas and relate them to yourself. And that's what we tend to do, and I talked a little bit about that last week, about how much of our life is made up of relating what happens to us to ourselves, to some image or idea we have of who we are. And it's just constantly relating things to ourselves, which is what we're trying to put to rest a little bit when we do a mindfulness practice. The Buddha was giving advice to a man named Bahiya about practice, and the Buddha said this to him. Bahiya, you must train yourself in this way. In the seen, there will just be the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the reflected, just the reflected. In the cognized, just the cognized. This is how, Bahiya, you must train yourself. Now, Bahiya, when in the seen, there will be... when in the seen, you have just seen the seen, and so forth, you should not identify yourself with what you've seen. When you do not identify yourself with it, then you will not locate yourself therein. When you do not locate yourself therein, it follows that... there will be no inner or outer or in between. And this is the end of suffering. So we don't locate ourselves in anything that happens to us. We don't say, this thing that's happening to me is me. That's holding a view, an opinion. We're relating it to some conceit or some ego or some idea of self. The challenge of mindfulness practice is to see if it's possible to be present for our experience without relating it to ourselves. To hear the sounds of the birds and not want to make a recording so we can take it home and listen to it when we're stressed. Or, you know, you can make up your own stories because I'm sure you have your own scenarios in which you have related what's happened to you. Part of the problem with views is that aside from the many difficulties that can arise, we can enter into quarrels and disputes and anxiety about views. I love Kierkegaard's expression, fear and trembling. Views very much involve a lack of perspective. And part of what spiritual practice, any spiritual practice, I hope, but certainly mindfulness practice, part of what mindfulness practice involves is developing or cultivating different perspectives by which we can see our life and our reality. And perspectives are different than views. So to get a change perspective, I like the expression they have in England, apparently. Say, you haven't understood England until you've left. No one understands England unless they've been abroad. And one way to go abroad, in a very radical and transformative way, I think, is to settle and penetrate the different realms of the mind, to understand your mind in a very powerful way, and settle a lot of the surface chatter that colors the way we see the world. So we learn in meditation to simply let ourselves rest in ourselves, on ourselves, without running after views, opinions, without creating complicated relationships and entanglements with what's happening, without evaluating what's happening. And in a sense, we taste, from that kind of resting with ourselves, we taste another kind of possibility, another perspective on how to live a life. And it can be very eye-opening to a lot of people to realize for the first time that they don't have to go around evaluating and judging things over and over and constantly over again. That there's another way of having a human mind, another way of having a human heart. And that can come pretty quickly when you do meditation practice. It settles to some degree, the mind. The deeper you go in practice, the more we discover we don't need to hold on to anything. The more we discover we don't need to have opinions and ideas about anything at all in order to find ourselves at peace or at home in this world, in ourselves. We don't have to hold on to any kind of judgment or evaluations. I think to have a taste, even if it's just a small taste, of what it's like not to need anything at all, can change a person's life. And that's very frightening for people to give up even the notion that they need things, let alone actually give them up, the things that they're holding on to. But it's not necessary, you don't need anything to be at home. One of the important experiences for me in my life was when I was in my late teens, early 20s, was the time that I spent hitchhiking around. I spent a lot of time hitchhiking around the United States and hitchhiking around Europe. And I used to feel so free hitchhiking. You know, I was just a young man and I had nowhere to go and nothing to do and no ideas of what I was, you know, anything, you know, really. What was become my life, and I didn't really care that much. And there were times I found myself on the road with my thumb out, not really knowing where I was going next. And I felt so thoroughly free. And I remember sometimes actually being disappointed getting a ride. Because I just loved being out there in the freedom of this open expanse. And I used to, this is a little bit embarrassing, but I used to sing to myself, it was my theme, was Janis Joplin's song, Bobby McGee, Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. That was my kind of, I just ended up hitchhiking. Freedom. And it was an important experience for me because that I carry with me to this day in some sense, because I had some very powerful experiential sense of what it was like not to have any kind of supports or props, not to need anything, and just basically have a few dollars in my pocket and some bread and not to need anything. And I'm often reminded of that when I get caught up in my concerns. More importantly than that, I think for me, has been my meditation experiences. Much more than kind of being alone in the middle of a highway somewhere, I think the solitude that comes from meditation shows us even more clearly, more deeply, what it's like to be without any attachments, without what it's like not to hold on to anything, to be in some and experience some kind of ultimate solitude. In the 8 months I was in retreat in Burma, I spent 8 months basically in a small room that's about 10 by 15, and didn't talk to anybody for 8 months, except the meditation teacher. And I spent hours and hours in this little room. And aside from the kind of solitude and kind of settledness that comes from the meditation practice, I felt that for me that I was alone with the universe, with this vast cosmos sitting there in this closed little room, my cell. And I felt there, much more than ever hitchhiking, the joy and the freedom of not needing anything at all. And that, even more than hitchhiking, stays as kind of an embodied kind of sense in my bones that reminds me often when I do get caught up in things, I need to get somewhere, or something needs to get done. Or just today, so I'm a TA at Stanford, and I had to turn in my grades for my students. So I showed up to the secretary, and she said, "Oh, you can't do it with me because I don't do this. You have to take it to someone else." Well, someone else was at a dissertation defense. You don't walk in on a dissertation defense asking for the grade sheets. And I'm not planning to come down to Stanford again this week. So, well, how am I going to do this then? Because I need to turn in the grades. I don't want to come down again. And I was kind of off. Secretary was not cooperative. And I was getting kind of worried, you know. My life was out of control. And then somehow, at some point, there was a shift. This kind of physical sense arose in me. And I don't need anything at all. Nothing I need. And it didn't mean that I stopped having views, that views like it was important to get it done, and I should try to take care of this best I can. It would be good if I can figure out how to do it today rather than driving a special trip down on Wednesday or something. But suddenly it became, all that view became very much lighter. And I believe that my mind became more clear thinking. And it was easier for me to actually think more clearly about what needed to be done when I let go of my attachment than when I had it. So it isn't that we're not supposed to have any. It isn't that we're supposed to have no views at all, but we're not. We need to understand, physically, experientially, what it's like to be attached to views. So you might pay attention to views when opinions and beliefs come up. See if you can start developing a sense of what it's like in your body to be attached. And if you can be a sense of that, if you can learn that, then there might be a possibility of not being attached, to let go of the attachment. How simple can we be? This is written by a priest who visited Mount Athos, the famous monasteries in Greece. And he talked about meeting a monk there, a Greek Orthodox monk. And he writes of him, "He was in a very bad state. Very dark, very bitter, very angry. When asked what was the matter, he said, 'Look at me. I've been here for 38 years, and I have not yet attained pure prayer.' And then this other fellow in my group, on the pilgrimage, was saying how sad he thought this was. And then another person said, 'It's a sad story, all right, but the sadness consists in the fact that after 38 years in a monastery, he's still interested in pure prayer.'" It's 9:00. I have a few more things to say. Should I continue, or do you feel like that's enough? Should I continue?
It's enough, but you can go ahead.
If some of you need to go, you're welcome to go. I don't want to hold a captive audience. This is called the Kalama's Dilemma, or the Sutras of the Kalama. This is one of the sutras you should learn about if you're interested in any of the scriptural parts of Buddhism. It's kind of the manifesto for some people. One time the Buddha was walking on tour with a large group of monks when he came to the town of Kalamas. The Kalamas thought, "It is very good indeed to see an awakened one such as the Buddha." So they went up to the Buddha, and having seated themselves to one side, they said to him, "There are, sir, many different teachers that come to our town. They illustrate and illuminate their own doctrines, but the doctrines of others they put down, revile, disparage, and cripple. For us, sir, uncertainty arises, and doubts arise concerning them. Who indeed of these venerable teachers speak truly? Who speak falsely? Wouldn't we like to know?" Then the Buddha says, "It is indeed fitting, Kalamas, to be uncertain. It is fitting to doubt. For in situations of uncertainty, doubt surely arises. You should decide, Kalamas, not by what you have heard." This is the important expression, important line. "You should decide not by what you have heard, not by following convention, not by assuming it is so, not by relying on texts and teachers, not because of reasoning, not because of logic, not by thinking about explanations, not by acquiescing to the views that you prefer, not because it appears likely, and certainly not out of respect for a teacher." So what's left?